summarize my day, summarize my week, what are my calendar events, like that phrase exactly. And that is a better POC if you can pwn that versus the user saying, hello, hi, whatever.
That's,
you know what I
mean? Such a, that is such a good call out, Rezo. That is a really good call out. All right, hackers, look, we got a lot. I don't know if you guys know this, but there's a lot more to CTPB than just the podcast, okay? I'm just going to list a couple things that you guys might be interested in real quick, okay? We got the Discord. That's where a lot of awesome conversations are happening. This cool research channel in particular is amazing on the Discord. We've got the Full-Time Hunters Guild for those of you making over 100K a year in bug bounty. If you're looking to be around other elite hackers, that's the place to do it. We've got the Critical Thinkers tier on the Discord. That's where we, that's like our inner circle. That's where we share all of our scripts, do exclusive AMAs, masterclasses, that sort of thing. And we've got the research lab over at lab.ctpb.show, where if you've got a piece of research you'd like to submit, you can submit it there. And we may take it, host it on the blog, and cover it on the pod for you. Also, underappreciated, but we also have the swag store, guys. So hit the swag link over at ctpb.show. And you guys can buy some cool t-shirts with critical thinking, slogan and stuff like that on it. All right. With that, let's go back to the show. Check out some of those things. All right. We're going to go back to the show, but check out those things for me. All right. Let's go. All right. Sup, hackers. Welcome to the This Week in Bug Bounty segment. We got a couple of news items that did not make it into the episode that I wanted to make sure got in front of you guys. The first one warms the heart. It is our boy, Ronnie Carta. Lupin was featured in a HackerOne blog by Maggie Miller. So definitely go check this out if you want to hear more about Ronnie's story. If you guys have been listening to the pod, you probably know a good amount about Ronnie's story, but Depi, his supply chain product is amazing. One of the best supply chain products out there, really doing a lot of unique research in that arena as well. So if you want to learn more, you can check out the link. We'll put it in the description. It's on the HackerOne blog under Ronnie Carta Bug Bounty. Next is Kaido actually released a new plugin called AuthSwap. This is by Bebex. And this one, I just wanted to show you guys this for those of you that are watching on YouTube. It's just a really awesome plugin that allows you to swap your sessions super easy. So you define these user profiles. You say, okay, set this cookie for this user, set this cookie for that user, right? And then it just puts these buttons in your replay where you've got user A, user B, and you can just press them and it applies that transformation to your open replay request, right? So it makes it really easy for you to swap sessions and go after those auth vulnerabilities, which are just everywhere. We're releasing a lot of stuff like this with Kaido right now. We've got like, I know some people have been doing Authify, there's Authorize, there's Auth Matrix, there's AuthSwap. So there's a lot of auth-based plugin for whatever you are going after in Kaido. And we've also got some shift stuff coming there too. So be on the lookout there. But this is a very manual approach, right? And I know that aligns with some of the bug bounty hunters that really like to do everything themselves to ensure full coverage. So check out AuthSwap if you're interested in that. Okay, last is something a little interesting. I wanted to tell you guys about Takumi. Okay, Takumi is GMO securities, flat securities, continuous source code review AI. Okay. So there are a lot of people building AI products right now, but I know the guys that are building this, and I know that Takumi is amazing. Okay. The way that it's implemented, it does an excellent job and it's very affordable. If you go to the website flat.tech/Takumi, TAKUMI, then you can check it out. It's very affordable. It's free for open source products, right? 0 yen per month. And the basic plan is 7 monen, which is 70,000 yen, which is about $450 USD. And this contains, I think what it says here is that it contains about 1 month's worth of credits where you can do source code review, okay? Using the AI. Very good stuff. Very good results out of here from what I've seen under the hood. Wanted to make you guys aware of that. This is like really the S tier stuff in Japan. So if you're wanting to try to understand, you know, take advantage of what companies are ahead in other markets, then you should definitely check out Takumi because they are ahead in my opinion. All right, that's all I had for this week. Let's get back to the show. All right, man. I feel like I got to be real with the audience on this one. Like, right before, I'm like squeezing this little stress ball thing so hard right now, because right before we got on the air, I have been fighting with a CSS issue in this plugin that I'm coding for like an hour and a half. And I just...
It's totally not even worth your time. But...
I'm about to lose it, dude. CSS, I freaking love CSS, but I hate CSS, dude. I really do.
Oh, why is it so complicated? It feels like it's like a stack of layered complexity on top of a million other things. And yeah. I know you specifically are complaining about Tailwinds as like, dude, another...
you know, I love the Kaida team. I love them. I love them to death. But they're on this whole Tailwind kick and I just can't get behind it. And I just don't like the added complexity of like classes and, oh, did it like generate the correct class? I don't know. There's all sorts of stuff with it, but
has Jan given you his bull case for it?
Like, he has, and he's right, okay. Of course, you know, but for me, like I, you know, I'm just a simple hacker, you know, man, right. I'm not a dev, you know, all I want to do is just like pop open dev panels, tweak it to how I want it to look, copy the CSS, save. Put it in there, you know, like yeah. Put it in inline screen, you know, like whatever. But, yeah. Okay. All right.
Nice, dude.
Just breathing through this.
So what you're actually saying for the listener is if they hear any rage behind your voice about anything, yes. It's not intended at the content. It's just you've got this.
It's
like,
Ian's fault is what it is.
Yeah, it's Ian's fault.
Right. Yeah, no. all right, dude, let's get to it. Well, actually, okay, before we jump into the DEF CON fun, I do want to talk to the listeners about a new... research piece that popped up through the lab. So let me go ahead and get that up. I thought I had it up before, but I don't. But this is just a cool, once again, we are trying to incentivize people with the research lab to do little microblogs with cool, you know, two paragraph, you know, this one's a little longer, but the TLDR is pretty short. Like, hey, this mm-hmm. is what I found. This is how it worked. Maybe you can use this little gadget, right? I just think that's yep. so valuable.
Super valuable.
Yeah. And so this one was awesome. This one was actually relating to Unicode surrogates and how I didn't really think about how they would affect the specific databases and them being converted via Unicode normalization or not knowing how to represent these things into the question mark character, right? Yep. So here's the write-up right here. And the TLDR of it is, you know, there are some scenarios in which these Unicode surrogates in particular, you know, other Unicodes may not, but these surrogates that are often used in emojis will get normalized into a question mark character. And the question mark character, obviously, we know, you know, I thought about it in the context of URLs. Okay, you know, it's going to truncate the URL, whatever. That's
really
awesome.
Is this basically
awesome
like... Mm-hmm. Two separate conversions. Like one thing is falling back into a question mark like character, and then it's being translated to the question mark later.
I'm not sure. That's a great point. It could be like that conversion between Unicode into the Unicode question mark, and then the Unicode question right. mark into the actual
that's,
normal question
that's
mark.
That's how I understood. Yeah.
Yeah. It certainly could be, but however it worked out, it panned out. This character and other Unicode characters, this specifically one is Unicode code point DC2A, was being converted into a question mark. And that question mark was then being converted into a wildcard character in Solr or Elasticsearch. He's not sure which one because of the situation, but he looked into it and found two databases that use it as a wildcard character. So that is clutch. And I totally didn't think about it in like the SQL or like the database perspective, right? Versus like the URL query parameter perspective.
Yeah. So is this basically like when you're fuzzing, like when you're looking for interesting things and you're looking for characters that might bypass specific like parsing or things like that, people just need to be aware of potentially testing for surrogate pairs?
Yeah. Exactly. And seeing cool. if those are normalizing into question marks and whether those question marks, the big thing for me is that, oh, of course, those question marks can be converted into, you know, wildcard characters. That was the big thing. Cause I knew, you know, I know Unicode normalization sometimes through the pipes or whatever ends up with a question mark at some point.
Right.
But specifically this surrogate, does this and then results in a question mark, which can be used as a wildcard in a database. Wasn't something I'd really, really thought through.
Yeah, I feel like it always get normalized to the question mark inside the little square icon. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I bet then that's getting converted to a real question mark, which is being interpreted as the wild card.
And if it, even if it wasn't in his scenario, I'm sure that does exist. That scenario does exist. Right. So,
yeah.
All right, dude. So for this episode, we kind of went back through a bunch of different DEF CON videos that finally got posted, and we finally got around to actually watching them and tried to pull out some juicy goodness for you guys, the listener. I've got, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 talks that I can talk about. I don't know how many you grabbed, but
I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but mine's more like 3 and then like 2 that are so deeply technical on things that I'm not an expert in, but I still pulled out some like things that I thought were worth mentioning.
Yeah, dude. And then you've got like some mega list over here as well.
Oh, I just put the whole list of the Bug Bounty Village talks in case we wanted to like comment on those. I mean, obviously, it's so many people that we know well. And so I didn't know if there were any of these that you had heard good things about or had heard mentioned. So
yeah,
I just put the full list in here.
Dude, I was a little salty to not be able to make it to a lot of the talks this year. Like I had to like in and out DEF CON this year. And
do you know if those were recorded or if they'll be put up anywhere? I feel like I heard they're not or something.
Sort of recorded, okay. I think. Okay. So I messaged Harley and I'm trying to get like, you know, I'm trying to see if he'll just give me the recording so that I can, you know, condense some of the information down. But yeah, I think they'll be up eventually, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sweet.
But let's dive into it. The first one that first we can't talk about DEF CON talks without mentioning the HTTP 1.1 must die from James Kettle and the Portswigger research team. We're not going to talk about that because we did a whole episode on that already. So go listen to that episode if you haven't already. The one that I wanted to start off with is actually Prompt Scan Exploit AI's Journey Through 0 Days by the Expo team. And this one was interesting because they didn't actually get to give the talk at DEF CON. They had to record it afterwards and post it on the website. So this video, I think, only has like 1,000-something views.
Very, oh my goodness.
Very few people
literally
have seen
bleeding
it.
I haven't seen it. I need to go watch it.
It's good, man. There's a lot of good content in there. So let me pick out a couple of the things. You should definitely go watch it yourself. But let me pick out a couple of the key points for me. So the first one is they kind of, you know, about halfway through the talk, you know, they cover all like the how Expo works and like the output things that they do the blog posts off of. They covered those. But then later on, they covered the challenges that they faced while building Expo that bug bounty hunters should be aware of if they're building their own AI systems, which I happen to be doing right now. right. You know, so I was like, oh, this is very interesting. But the first challenge that they came up against was saying that they noted was AI costs are high versus traditional costs. But they really did map this out. And we've seen this time and time again. AI costs are going to continue to drop. We saw a 76% cut. What is this between Gemini Pro 1.5 at launch and Gemini 1.5 Pro in 2024, in half two of 2024. So, and we're going to see, and we saw another 86% drop after that. So like the costs are just continuing to just tank for these things.
Let's say I do think a lot of people might be skeptical about that. There are many people I know, which I don't necessarily agree with, that think that the bubble's going to pop and that this is basically companies burning
subsidization
investor funds, right? Like, yeah, they're just trying to mass adopt users. But I think that what's really crazy and really cool is that so many of these models are like, they get distilled, they get reused, they get fine tuned. They like, it seems like even when let's say if the latest and greatest models went up in price, which I don't actually know that I believe they will, the previous models, which are just still insanely good, like Gemini 2.0 Flash and like even this, it's like in the screenshot, it's 1.5, right? They're already at 2.5. And I think 3 just recently came out or is at least in testing already on like some of the Battle Arena sites. And so I think like even if the prices don't like stay low forever, these older models are still really capable for things like this.
Yeah. Yeah. So essentially their takeaway here was like, don't worry about cost of AI right now.
Exactly.
You know, just build it. And then eventually, you know, the older models are going to be so cheap. It's like, who gives a lily, yep. You know?
Exactly.
And I do agree with that. And I also think models that are open source are also getting pretty good. And so then you kind of just have to pay for energy. which is which by the way is not inconsequential. You know, like like it does cost money, real money, guys. Your energy bill will feel it if you're running like AI stuff constantly. I once was like calculating out, you know, I got this big server from the store, or you know, and I was like, I'm gonna run it in my basement and kill my VPS costs. And I'm like calculating out, I'm like, oh shit, this is gonna cost me like $15 a month in electricity. I should just spin up a VPS, you know? Like,
exactly. Yep. Exactly.
So yeah, there are some gotchas there. Okay. Challenge three, skipping over a couple. Too many assets, right? Mm-hmm. They were saying, okay, this is a problem. We've got too many URLs, too many things to scan. So they did a couple things. One, they used, they parsed the scope, easy peasy. We're not going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about the two other things. Scoring and deduplication. Okay, scoring and deduplication. Scoring is essentially the way they approached identifying which targets are interesting. They created like this massive 80, it looked like 80 or so attribute list for these targets. It says, does it have GraphQL? Does it have forms? Does it have an API? Does it have a password reset? You know, those sort of things. Yes or no. And then it asked the AI those questions and rated each one of the hosts, right? And then it would focus on the host that has the highest scoring rating.
Like it's almost like a likelihood to be vulnerable type scoring.
Yeah.
Like if it's a plain hello world page with nothing on it, it would just rank it a zero because there's no functionality there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And and so and you know obviously there are situations where it's like you know there's some hidden path or whatever. But I mean this is a good start, and I think that cut down about 45% of their targets. You know they're able to focus more on the top. You know, 45%.
Well, the reason why I love this, I've obviously talked to a lot of Hackbot companies. The vast majority are not approaching Hackbot in this way. Mm-hmm. Like the thing that I love that Expo has done all the way since the beginning relative to other Hackbot companies is like, it's felt like they wanted to be a full black box. Like here, you're given this bug bounty program. Now go like attack it.
Yeah.
The majority of the other companies, they just take input as URL. Mm-hmm. And so like, they're not even worried about the problem of like, which domain do I look at? So I think it's just kind of cool that they even wanted to solve this problem in the first place.
Totally.
Like that it was a part of their desire was to actually decide which subdomains to look at.
It's part of the bug bounty design, man. You know, it really is. You know, these guys are bringing a bunch of bug bounty automation experience into this whole thing, which is invaluable to Expo, I'm sure. So the next one was deduplication. I think this one was interesting because I've seen a bunch of people try to address this problem, right? We've seen the top hackers, you know, in the automation world try to address this. Sometimes you do visual distance based off of screenshots. Sometimes you do like DOM hashing. You parse the DOM and you try to like use sim hash and like you know,
strip out the dynamic content.
Exactly.
And try to hash it.
Yeah, and you try to figure out what's dynamic and what's not. The one that they mentioned here that was very interesting was they use text content and embeddings.
Yeah.
And really
and
weird.
Then created bringing like AI this, back
exactly,
into it. You know?
Exactly. So I'm like, okay, you know, this is a very interesting thing here. Like, we're not necessarily you know, going to be using AI here, but we are doing this embedding process, right? Mm-hmm. You know, or like we're not going to be using LLMs like, hey, you know, take this and like tell me what it is, you know? But instead you are using some of the core technology behind it that allows you to take meaning and assign it to like a vector, you know, a series of numbers. And then, you know, use that to identify, okay, you know, are these, you know, what is the cosine difference between this one and this one? And say, okay, wow, these are really similar. Like we should, these are probably dupes. Right. So, so then you dedupe much more efficiently there based off of meaning, you know, versus off of like whatever visual display or you know, whatever hashing the techniques we have. So I just thought that was a really unique way of solving that problem.
It's super cool. And my thing, like immediately my brain jumps to, I want to see it in visual space. I want to see a three-dimensional like node graph of, which I mean, I guess they actually do have that for image based already, don't they? But anyways, yeah, for vector based, I feel like it's like actually a representation of really what the vectors are. You know, of course you're condensing down some sort of like 1 million dimension space down to like 3D, but it would be cool to see like little clusters of domains based on that.
Dude, that would be sick. that would be totally sick. That was not where my brain went at all. My brain was
really?
My brain was like, great. deduplication.
Well, anytime I think of vector space, that's how I visualize it. Yeah. It's just like a big 3D space. And, you know, by vectorizing, you're taking that content and you're putting it at a single point. And so whenever you say cosine similarity distance, I think, oh, those points are really close in that 3D space. Mm-hmm. And so now what do I want to see for uniqueness for like anomalies is like what's not close to the other ones. So I imagine if you mapped it onto 3D space, you would see a whole bunch of domains that are all together. And then you would see some like that are like kind of off on their own. And it'd be cool to be able to just click those to go to them.
Yeah, that would be cool. That'd be super cool. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I thought that was really unique. The next challenge that they represented was boundaries, you know, setting scope, staying in scope, that sort of thing. And they, one of the ways that they did this was they implemented dynamic DNS. For this whole thing. So they're just not resolving some of the domains that are not in their scope. And I think that that is a good solution to solve it at the DNS level. You know, some of the LLM stuff can
it's gonna break so many sites though.
Yeah. Yeah, it could, but I think you can also do some contextual awareness on it, right? Like let's say it's loading a third party script or whatever. And that third party script, you know, you need to respond with like, you know, you sandbag it to your server and respond it with like a 200 and an empty JS file or something like that, you know?
I feel like it's better just to like not let it modify requests to sites that aren't in scope, but just still let it load.
Or maybe everything. Like let it load stuff,
right.
But like don't let it target it, focus right, on
exactly. Don't let it send requests to that, yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. And then, so challenge number 7, number 8, was essentially this whole concept of how do we get the most out of the models. And what they were saying is they actually saw a really big increase in efficacy when switching back and forth between different models. Essentially, like every rotation of the agent, flip a coin, pick a model, you know, like and just, you know, distribute it, right? You know, going for like this statistical approach. Because what'll happen is one model will get stuck. Yeah. Right. And it'll get stuck and it'll rotate. But, you know, somewhere in that rotation, a different model's getting added in to the mix. And then that model will bring its own perspective. And then that'll get handed back to the other model. And that's the breakthrough needed to like continue going further. Right. Sure. So just like by subbing in and out different models, you get differences in approach. And they said that that increased efficacy a lot, which I was kind of surprised because I feel like it would be kind of a scatterbrained, like, oh, let me try this. Oh, let me try this. No, I'm going to go this way. But really, it seemed to work well from what they said.
Yeah, I remember. I think we covered that on like a podcast episode a little bit ago when they kind of first published that paper. Or maybe when we were talking to Diego, we mentioned that. But yeah, I agree. I think that models today all feel so similar. They all are like, as long as you're getting ones in the same class, right? Like if you're comparing GPT-5 to Gemini 2.5 Pro to Claude 4 or whatever, it feels like they're all like kind of the same intelligence. But yeah, I mean, I guess that the internal structures are like very different. And so you're going to get like different approaches, different attempts.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the last thing that they mentioned was there are diminishing returns on number of rotations per vulnerability type. So, you know, what they're saying is, okay, you know, it typically only on average, it's only going to take me, you know, 8 times or whatever to get this XSS.
Right.
And then it produces diminishing returns, right? So like per vulnerability class, understand where the optimal point of ROI is on number of rotations versus output of valid vulnerabilities, and then limit your agent to that to maximize like your output of vulnerabilities, because instead you can allocate those computing resources to another endpoint, which is going to produce more vulnerabilities.
Yeah, it's so cool that you can basically gamify anything these days. Like you can create an evaluation. And so I'm sure that's what they did, right? They were like, oh, let's create an evaluation and figure out if it hasn't figured out by 4 steps, it's never going to figure it out.
Yeah.
So just don't waste any cycles after that and just stop right at 4 steps, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty solid. So overall, a really good talk, definitely underrated. I'm going to link it in the description. You guys should check it out. Anybody who's even remotely thinking about using AI or integrating AI or creating an AI hacking product should check that out, because there's a lot of lessons learned and they're sharing very freely. All right. You want to take the next one?
Yes. And you had a different opinion on this one. So I think it's going to be kind of exciting for us to talk about it.
Yeah.
I even went back and like parsed through it before we recorded it, and I think you're wrong. So here, we'll talk about it.
All right. We'll debate it.
So it's called Breaking Into Thousands of Cloud-Based VPNs with One Bug. And this is a talk by David Cash and Rich Warren. I'm sure these guys are legends outside of the bug bounty industry. I'm sure they're like amazing hackers. I think that they're from the UK. But anyways, they basically found a bunch of bugs in Zscaler and Netskope. I think presumably it seemed like it was because they run into them so often on their pen tests. And so they wanted to kind of like, you know, be able to really compromise them. I personally thought that one of the coolest things they did, and in their slide deck, like every few slides, once they found vulnerabilities, they would like check it off. They basically created a wish list of bugs. And in general, I think that like achievement or like, you know, a task-based hacking is really valuable. We've talked about it a little bit on the pod. I think you specifically do this kind of a lot, right? When you're going to live hacking event, it's like, oh, I want RC on this feature, or I want to be able to like listen to anybody's conversation in this device, right? It's like you set up a goal and then you go and get it. And usually somehow it's just like the stars align to make it possible. It's probably because everything is vulnerable if you work hard enough.
Yeah.
But I think that's just really cool as like a takeaway for bug hunters as like a wish list. I did think that it was neat. They had a multiple items on their wish list, right? Yeah. Like I feel like as hackers, sometimes we go to events saying like, oh, I want RC and this thing. And it's just like one. Having the wish list is pretty neat because you can probably pivot between them.
Yeah. I think there's, you know, point of diminishing returns with that as well, right? Like you're like, you need to stay focused, but maybe, you know, be open to the possibilities of how the system is implemented, you know, where the vulnerabilities might be. But I definitely like that concept as well. And I think it's especially applicable to appliances and IoT devices or whatever, right? Because, you know, oftentimes there are just very specific things you want to do, like prone to own, all about shelling the device, right? And so you've got a very narrow focus there and it makes it a lot more intense for sure.
Yeah. So I personally was surprised by how much AppSec there was in this. You may disagree, but I mean, there was like so many slides they had that were basically like, here's the HTTP request and here's the HTTP response and like kind of were breaking it down, which I was delightfully pleased by because they were often looking at like, you know, the desktop installs of these apps. But anyways, they one thing that I thought was like a really great takeaway was they found pre-auth configs for both Zscaler and Netskope. And I'm pretty sure that still existed today. That wasn't like some vulnerability. I think that what was in there was a little bit too much data. Whenever I was at AppOmni and did SaaS security, I also found this on Workday, for example. A lot of SaaS-based apps that are like multi-tenant will, for some reason, have like some sort of like externally available config. It'll usually include things like the org name or some other stuff. And you can like garner a little bit of information about it. Sometimes it's not, it's usually not a vulnerability, but it gives you a lot of information about the target. In this case, a couple of them were actually vulnerabilities, but I thought that it was, I thought that it was pretty neat. You can see actually, well, I won't share, but for the audience, there's a there's an endpoint for Netskope that's like git/mobile/user/pack and then ?org key. And so as long as you have the org key, which is able to be found in a couple different ways they talk about in the talk, so you should go watch that. But you can like return a bunch of information about that org. And it very often included sensitive things like routes, internal host, external host. And in some cases, it would even include keys and stuff. But I thought that that was one thing is neat. I like meta concepts. And I think in SaaS, having like a pre-auth config as like a meta concept to know to look for or to like Google for us. Like if you're trying to target a specific, you know, desktop thing or SaaS thing and you're like, hey, what's the pre-auth config URL for this app, right? And then that gives you more information about it and sometimes might be leaking things that shouldn't.
Dude, those meta ideas are just going to become more and more and more valuable though, as we, you know, as well as we move into a bunch of AI stuff, supplemented hacking over the next couple of years, because those meta concepts are going to be able to be pulled out and applied specifically. Yeah, totally. And I think I've definitely seen this as well, you know, with these appliances, you've got to look for, I mean, this is kind of what it boiled down to. You know, I kind of covered this in a talk a while back when I was talking about my approach to hacking Grafana back in like 2020. But essentially, it's like, you just got to look at the routes, you know, look at the routes, look at the unauthenticated routes. And then that is your, what you can work with, you know, you've got, if you want an unauthenticated bug, you've got two options, you bypass auth or you work with the unauthenticated routes, you know, like, and so, you know, you just kind of break it down into the steps and you work through them. But yeah, I thought that that talk was really interesting. I think that there's certainly a lot of, there's certainly a lot of AppSec in there, like you were saying, right? A lot of, you know, web hacking. And I think a lot of the IoT hacking that you actually do with these apps is to get to the AppSec stuff, right? It is to get to the web hacking, right? So I think that makes a lot of sense to me. You just got to try to keep pushing at the IoT, you know, side until you get the source code or you're able to like proxy the traffic and understand what's actually happening in the realm of like communication. So,
yeah, they blast right by in the talk. I don't have it in my notes here, but one of the things they like very quickly did was there was some sort of like client side encryption or something that was like, you know, signed by like an AES key. And then that, like, by figuring that out, then you're able to actually like see like what was actually going on, what was in the request and all that. I think that's something that when I often run into something, you know, complicated like that client side, I usually just like move on. But I think that figuring that sort of stuff out is like obviously the birth of all bugs. Like that's like, that's where the real bugs are found.
Yeah. Big breakthrough moments there for sure. Like I remember in my very limited experience of hacking routers, like this has happened twice and, you know, where we needed to push some, you know, public key by some endpoint. And then that opens up just like a ton of different, you know, RPC calls or whatever we can do over a different protocol.
You mentioned like hardware a couple of times. This was all cloud-based VPN, so I think that it was all just software related.
Yeah. I'm talking more about like appliances, right? You know, I'm thinking about it from an IoT perspective because that's where a lot of my experience is. I haven't like done a bunch of like appliance hacking, but like the principles are somewhat cross, you know, cross applicable. The nice thing about appliances though is that oftentimes you can just, you know, jump right into the software realm. Whereas like, you know, with hardware, okay, first I've got to like, you know, either pull the chip off, get the firmware, or I've got to figure out how to get a shell on it so that I can like then get access to the software layer. Right.
So, right. Yeah. Cool. So in general, I think that that's neat. They said, actually, this is at the bottom of my notes, but there's still Netskope installs out there without secure enrollment enabled. And so in those, you can basically still either bypass auth or get access to some of these like sensitive information. So people should look for that. And there are CVEs and I'm pretty sure there are POCs and stuff from their talk. The other main thing I wanted to mention, and this is something that me and Monkey Kieran found when we were hacking a few different SaaS applications/companies when we were at AppOmni, was just like bad SAML implementations are everywhere. It's so hard to like deploy SAML properly because it's just complicated, right? And devs really struggle to do it. And they cracked both Netskope and Zscaler SAML implementations. And there are like there's like recurring things that are possible that I've seen in my research and in stuff like this. One is that very often it's making sure that there like is a valid signature and not that the signature is like good for you. So if you have a cross org, like if you can go create an instance of this org or a tenant of the org and like create your own like signed SAML requests, it often just works for all tenants. And then the other things you can do is a lot of times they won't validate some of the fields in there. So as long as it's a good signature, the fields inside of the SAML request can be anything. So you can test for other users, you can test for other orgs. There are lots of things to test for when it comes to SAML. And I think that doesn't get tested much either because it is kind of complicated. But with AI these days, like all the top models can write Python scripts that'll like sign SAML stuff for you. It's like it's not a big deal at all anymore. And I think the best way to test is actually just to create your own org, and then you can just like proxy your own traffic in your own tenant and then just change it to other users values or other org values.
Yeah. It is a little bit more challenging when you don't have the ability to do that, right? You're just kind of black box testing the SAML implementation, but there are some really good articles out there still. I remember there's one from Uber a while back where somebody like totally pwned the SAML implementations of Uber. Definitely a ton of good bugs there. And I know I've been meaning to get a hacker one, the guy that keeps doing a bunch of like crazy SAML stuff on here. So we could talk about that, but we do have a pretty solid episode on SAML. I forget which one it is, but it's way back.
It has to be old.
Yeah. But like that episode, I've gone back and listened to myself talk about SAML in that episode to test it. Yeah. So I think that one I hit pretty often.
Nice.
All right, man. Let's see. Next one that I want to talk about. This one's nice and quick. The title is Examining Access Control Vulnerabilities in GraphQL. It's like a field study, right? And he's talking about finding a bunch of vulnerabilities in a target with GraphQL. And I just wanted to shout this one out because I think this is a good example of like good GraphQL testing. And he breaks it down quite a bit. And one of the ones that I kind of walked away with like, oh yeah, that's something I didn't really think about before, is the difference between broken object property level authorization and broken object level authorization. So, you know, you sometimes will see scenarios, especially in GraphQL, where, you know, oh, you are supposed to be able to access this object, but you're not supposed to be able to access the sub-property of the object, right? And that is where a lot of the vulnerabilities lie in GraphQL.
That's interesting. Mm. Yeah, you're right. Because like very often I should be able to like view like user just an email, but not user just an anything else, yeah. right? It's like
password because if password
I,
reset
because
token.
If I go to your profile or whatever, it'll pull the user object of yours. And so that'll be like, it'll have some of those properties, but I won't be able to see all of them.
Exactly. Exactly. So just a quick shout out, if anybody's interested in doing some GraphQL stuff and wanted to brush up, that is a good place.
Were there any crazy bugs in there that you remember that you
there were a lot of crazy ones, dude. It was okay. A dating app that they were.
And, oh, nice. What was his tool of choice for testing it? Did he mention it?
You know, I didn't even pay attention to that. I was just looking at the data.
Yeah, sure.
So, yeah. All right. Next up for you.
Yeah, sure. I'll do a quick one from lower down in my list. I've got at least two quick ones, but one was so DEF CON 33 smart bus smart hacking, free Wi-Fi to total control. This guy is insane. Well, there's maybe two of them, but it was mostly just one guy. Basically, he like lives in China, I think Shanghai. But anyways, he's on a bus and he gets into a traffic jam and just like a classic hacker. He's like, let's just see if I can take over this bus. Before he arrived at his destination, he literally had taken the free Wi-Fi, gotten access to like an admin panel, pivoted to another admin panel. There was like two of them had the username, password, admin, got full access to like all the recordings and all the controls for every bus in his city. So it's just a cool talk, right?
No, I mean, of course. Way.
But the thing that I thought that was just interesting about it was it felt very much like those old Hussein write-ups that were like, you just get in via some way and it's like, and then this happened and then this happened and then this happened. You know, it felt like easy mode bug bounty targets where you get post auth and everything's just so easy and lined up for you. It's like, and then admin worked. And then I just found this route where it dumped everything. And then that, you know, that led to a domain over here where I could log in with admin again.
Yeah, dude, so. It's so good, man. It's so good. I love those scenarios. I my pulse is high right now, just thinking about it, you know?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, dude. Definitely, you know, things that aren't pen tested. I always forget because I spend so much time, you know, in the bug bounty world, but like how much of a palooza it is when you just like tack something that isn't, you know, intentionally being hardened. Oh my gosh.
Exactly.
It's crazy, man. All right. So next one that I had here was passkey pwn. That was it on that one, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Next one I had here is called passkey pwned, turning web auth in against itself. And this was very timely because I see passkeys everywhere all of a sudden. And I was like, I should kind of understand this a little bit better. So watched this this talk, and it was a very good explanation. Essentially, for those of you guys that haven't looked into it very much at all, the situation is this, you're just doing a public key, private key sort of thing here. So you give the server, you know, your public key or whatever, they're going to go ahead and correlate that public key to your account once you've done the registration. And then whenever you want to log in, they'll give you a challenge. You prove that you have the private key and then they just let you into your account. Right.
Do they sometimes feel too easy to you?
What do you mean? the like passkeys? Yeah. Oh, totally. 100%.
Like sometimes I'm like, is this feels too easy?
Yeah.
Like I feel like 2FA is supposed to feel like a little bit difficult, but it just feels like it feels almost too easy.
Totally.
It feels like it just like works without adding any difficulty.
Yeah.
But maybe it's just like you're just, I guess, confirming that like, you know, that is your device, right? Because basically if your device is pwned, then you do lose it.
Yeah. And I've got it hooked into 1Password or whatever.
Same. Yeah.
Yeah. And it just, you know, it pops up. I hit
automatically
okay, and then boom, you know, it's like, right. And then I'm in, I'm like, oh,
it doesn't, okay. It doesn't feel like true 2FA, you know,
but if they've got my 1Password, I'm fucked anyway, you know, like, right, it's exactly. Like, you know, no, what are
exactly.
You going to do?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, it's pretty bad. I think it's fine, but I do think that like, there's a lot of, ways that the attacker can utilize this, of course.
Yeah, cool. I'm excited to hear about it.
And so first, you know, I wanted to make sure you guys understand the private key, public key thing and how that works. It makes sense if you think about it. And then what the the guy mentioned here is that there's actually a lot of attack surface here for attackers. And mostly what he spent the time talking about was a malicious extension. You know, people just yeeting extensions into their browser all the time, and how easy it is for that extension to insert a content script, shim the navigator.credentials calls, right? Which is how you register and get your your passkeys. And then,
so that's what I was going to ask you was like, how does this, because there it does feel a little bit like voodoo magic, because on my Mac, for example, the passkey is accessible if I use my fingerprint. And on your phone or whatever, I think usually it's by Face ID or whatever. But there has to be some sort of, interface between the, you know, one password or the desktop or whatever that is handing over the public key into the HTTP, like into the browser, which is then going to pass it via HTTP. It feels weird. It feels like it's like going from like a physical desktop into HTTP land. And they're like, I'm curious what the interface is like.
Yeah, that's handled by the browser. You know, the browser itself is exposing navigator.credentials, which is the interface for pass keys. And then, you know, all of your various whether it be your desktop, one password, or like your phone's fingerprint or whatever, those are all sort of interacting with the browser from there, which is pretty solid. But I think it's really interesting as well, is like, you can definitely use this for ATO, by shimming those, that navigator credentials thing. If you can trigger somebody's, like auth for that in the passkey and they approve it, then, you know, that authentication material, right, that comes from the them doing that passkey activation, can then be used as authentication material to log into that user's account. And furthermore, if you shim it on registration, then you can just link your own malicious passkey to the victim's account. And I know that there's going to be a lot of scenarios where we're looking for ATO methodologies, and it's going to require a password to change password, but it's not going to require, you know, any additional auth to add a passkey. So be on the lookout for that as a way to get ATO once you've established XSS.
This makes me really curious. What are the protections in the browser to prevent like website A from, basically requesting a passkey for website B? Because then you like basically have the shim, right? Like, because it's like, it's your website, not the website they're logging into. I'm really curious how that, like what the segmentation is there. Like if you have XSS, can you all of a sudden shim it? If you have a post message listener, can you shim it? Like what does it take on the page to be able to shim it?
Definitely XSS. I'm trying to think about how it would emulate a different website. I imagine that handled at the browser level. Like once you call those navigation credentials things, it's like, oh, you know, this call is coming from Rhinorator.com or whatever. But I think there's also, you know, obviously the cryptographic aspect of it, like where the server is giving you a challenge, right? And then you're going to complete that. Interesting stuff there. And I also think that just going back to the XSS angle, that I think it would be really cool to see something, an exploitation framework for this, that can be generalized and just kind of included as an XSS script where, boom, I got XSS. Now I'm going to include this script, which shims the calls to navigator.credentials and then, registers my key maliciously or whatever.
Because that's what you want for your video POCs. Once you get XSS, is some sort of easy way to prove that it's critical, right? It's like, here's a video of me showing that with users, I can actually like steal their, get full ATO, including the passkey bypass.
Yeah. And I'm actually going to pull this up really quick and see if I can find the credentials here. I just wanted to make sure I was explaining this correctly, but the challenge is coming from. Okay. Yeah. Cool. We're good. I think we're good. It is complicated stuff, man. You know, it is. I don't know if you've had the same vibe, but like whenever, I do the episode for like the top 10 web hacking techniques or do like a DEF CON recap or something, I just have to ingest so much material very quickly and then be able to regurgitate it, you know, in a way that is like easy to explain and easy for the viewer to understand. It's tricky, dude. It's freaking tricky, man.
I mean, I think there's a lot of grace there, but you are definitely a person who is hard on yourself and expects.
I want to make sure that people know how it works. You know, it's important because I think a lot of the neurons need to fire as a hacker, right? You know, like even if you don't fully understand something, if you heard Justin talk about it that one time, then you're like, oh, I kind of understand how that works. And that doesn't really align with how I understand it. So maybe I should look into that a little more. You know, it's important. It's important.
Yeah, it is.
All right. What you got next?
This is one of the ones that, I thought was pretty interesting. I am not a mobile guy. So you might actually think that this part that I have highlighted is like much more interesting. I will mention how I got it. But basically, this talk is called Bypassing Intent Destination Checks, Launch Anywhere, Privilege Escalation. And I mean, the person's obviously wildly intelligent. Their name is Qidan Hay, Qidanhe. But I thought that so it was like there was like a focus on basically time of check to time of use vulnerabilities and how Android intents are like resolved and used. And yeah, while you're parsing that, if you want to explain it to the user in a minute, that's great. But one of the main things that I thought was super cool was that at the very end, he basically gave a prompt for how to find the bug using AI in like a code base. And I thought, man, what a cool thing to add to the end of your talk. And I just, I wish more people would do that, right? Like if you're looking for this and you're not, you know, an expert in this exact type of vulnerability, here's the prompt you can use to ask AI, say, hey, here's the code, like here's the decompiled code or whatever. Here's the thing I'm looking for. Does this exist in this place? And it was like, not like a specific signature for a thing. It was like, when this function is called in this way with this context and doesn't have this protection, then it's vulnerable. And so of course, like the, you know, top models today will be able to like kind of understand that and then look for it in the code and then tell you if that type of thing is in the code. And I just thought that was like really neat that he did that.
Dude, that's super beautiful. Yeah. I love that. I mean, that's the new, you know, or maybe improved version of like, here's the POC at the end, you know, the POC video, right? You know, you know, giving you the script and showing you how to use it, that sort of thing, giving a prompt to actually detect some of these code patterns. You know, I wish I could add more to what you were saying about this. But as I'm looking forward to it, or looking through this little, you know, summary that you have here, I didn't get the chance to read this one, but it seems very interesting. So I'm going to read a couple of these very cool points here. It seems like what he's talking about is something that I've kind of played around a little bit with just in post messages, which is in web. And it's essentially, you know, trying to use time of check to time of use race conditions to trick, you know, things going on. And we see this in post message where, you know, let's say, for example, we send a message and it does a fetch request and then it, you know, checks the origin, right? But in that meantime, you can do a very quick swap of the origin where the event source came from. And since it's pointing to a window reference, it says, oh, okay, that's coming from my place or whatever, you know, my buddy over here. And and then so it says, okay, I'm gonna do all the things. And then when it responds, you know, event.source.postmessage, then by that time you've already swapped it back to your cached HTML page. And now you can, you know, snag the response, right? So that's me thinking about it from a web world. I'm seeing some very interesting pieces of that here where he's talking about, okay, identifying and extending the time windows between security check and intent launches, and then using large malformed Android manifests to slow down the resolution process and widen time of check time of use windows. Dude, I am so excited to listen to this talk.
Anytime there's like a gadget that slows something down to get a race condition through, it feels like that's just like peak hacking.
Dude. Yeah. I love race conditions. Race conditions are so cool. Dang, Joseph, come on, be more of a mobile guy so that you can explain this.
If I was, maybe I'd be able to explain this better.
Yeah.
But yeah, basically, this little thing I did want to tell you, this little summary is just so good and clean. And I used the ask button in YouTube and basically said like, hey, you know, just as like a practical bug bounty hunter, what are the big takeaways, like the actual like practical advice or things to look for when I'm like testing similar things? And this is what it came out with, which is very clean.
Okay. I'm going to read this one summary at the top. The bad resolve vulnerability highlights that even if an intent is checked and deemed safe at one point, its resolution might change by the time it's actually launched, creating a window for privilege escalation. Oh my gosh. I know so what I'm doing right after this.
So bad resolve is an old vulnerability. His new one is called launch anywhere, I think. But
okay.
What exactly does it mean by resolution here? What is the resolution of an intent?
Dude, I wish I knew.
Okay. You're fine.
But you know, the way that I'm thinking of it is, you know, they're checking. How do I explain the resolution? I mean, I'm almost thinking it like a promise, you know, in JavaScript. I don't know if that's getting too.
No, that makes sense.
But you know, like, and then, you know, you check where it's from, you know, what it's supposed to be doing. And then by the time it's actually used, it's swapped. So I think that's really cool. I'm going to go check this out a little bit further after this.
Cool.
But yeah. Okay.
Sorry, this is one of those times when we really need Joel back. We need to bring in like guest appearance Joel here. Please come explain this to us, Joel.
Yeah, dude. But I mean, I totally feel you though, man. Some of these times, you know, you listen to some of these talks and you're like, I know that this is really cool and I can express, you know, to the people that this is cool, but I cannot explain all of it. Okay, so one of the ones that I chose was invoking Gemini agents with Google Calendar Invite, which is like very similar to a lot of the research that we've done and talked about before. But there was a couple things here that were good takeaways. Essentially, the TLDR of it was...
Who gave this talk?
Let me see. It's in the notes. I'll let you pull it up while I'm talking about it. But essentially, the TLDR of this was, you know, they'd invite you to a Google Calendar event and they'd say, hey, what's on my calendar? And then the prompt injection would just do a bunch of crazy stuff. So, you know,
you've reported this exact thing.
Yeah, we have. but you know, in this scenario, it like controlled windows, you know, turned up the boiler, you know, turned up your heat in your house, all sorts of stuff. And I thought one that was really amazing, but one of the tips that they gave in here was specifically, was targeting this phrase. Here are your events for this week, right?
Right.
And that is what they would be responding with constantly. You know, when it says, "Here are your events for this week," when you ask, you know, "What's on my calendar?" And so they targeted that phrase specifically.
Yep.
And were able to override the response of the LLM because they could predict what it was going to say, you know, as a part of its system prompt or as a part of its training, and then get it to invoke all sorts of different tools.
Yeah, I wanted to mention this. So I think I've noticed this in the last week. You know, you and I were in a hacking event that we won't have to go into too deeply here, but I noticed that a lot of people in that event and just in my other hacking for like another AI red teaming I've been doing, that in nearly every AI app these days, there's like a suggested prompt, right? It's like, summarize my day, summarize my week, what are my calendar events? Like that phrase exactly. And that is a better POC if you can pwn that versus the user saying, hello, hi, whatever.
That's,
you
know what I mean? That is such a good call out, Rezo. That is a really good call out.
It is, because like with Google, you and I know this. They're like, oh, at scale, this will get popped. We'll kind of trust you on any prompt. But a lot of these smaller bug bounty programs won't. Like, so if you're like, if your prompt that you're inputting that's going to go trigger a prompt injection is like, hey, can you tell me the 22nd thing I did last week on this other thing? And then it triggers the prompt injection. They're like, this is unrealistic. But when it's one of the hard-coded prompts that they just like can click or that they expect the users to always say or do, it almost always gets accepted. And it will sometimes, I think, even leave the it leaves the user interaction required at like a lower bar. It might not be UIL versus UIH, but it definitely leaves it there, right?
Dude. What a great call out, man. Like that's just one of those things, like, you know, you hear it and you're like, of course. But like, I totally never thought of that. And I've looked at, you know, I don't know. Let me not overstate that. I probably looked at like, you know, 20 AI apps by this point, you know, and I haven't thought of that. That's such a good point.
But I think what they did is like the next step, right? It's like they noticed that every time they clicked that, the LLM would respond with, here are your events for the week. So then they put in their prompt injection, here are the events for the week, and then all the things that they wanted it to do maliciously. So I think that's kind of like a two-step process there that's like pretty cool and valuable. It's like, one, what are the recommended prompts? And then what, when you use those, what's the model's language when it responds to you? And you want to kind of, what's that called? Mirror. You want to mirror the model's language in your prompt injection payload.
Yeah. So. It's almost like it's a, you know, you're trying to convince a human to do something, right? It's hilarious. It's like if you read like all those like sales, you know, technique books, or they're like, oh, you know, mirror your partner in the negotiation. And I'm like, wow, crazy, dude. I would add one more thing to the end of this. And I cannot believe I don't believe I checked this when I was working on Gemini, which stab in the heart, but, prompt injection to opening a URL and then swapping that URL via redirect to an intent URI. Oh my gosh. Like, that is such a good idea. I know we were playing around with that one night.
You can redirect to intents? I don't even know you can do that.
Yes, you can. Yeah. So, essentially what they did there was they did a prompt injection. You know, it then opened up an HTTP URL. That URL redirected to an intent URI, and it would just launch the app. And I'm like, oh my gosh.
Can you redirect to any protocol?
Yeah. And it's all up to the user agent, up to the browser or whatever, to decide what to do with it. And most of the time in Android, it will go ahead and prompt you, you know, and say like, hey, do you want to open the YouTube app? Right?
Sure.
But in this Gemini, you know, thing that they were talking about here, if you redirected to an intent URI from within the like embedded browser in Gemini, it would just open up the intent. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that is such a crazy thing. And it made me think of a Pwn to Own write-up I just recently it was a video that I was watching by Ken, I can't remember his last name, Ken Gannon. And essentially he was talking about how you need delivery. Delivery is a huge problem for these devices that you are trying to pwn and pwn to own, these mobile apps, right? How do I, without user interaction, you know, trigger these attacks? And one of the ways that could potentially do that is using these AI apps, right? That normal usage, hey, what's on my calendar, right? But that calendar has been hijacked.
Compromised. Yeah.
Yep. And then it, you know, opens up an HTTP URL, which redirects to an intent URI, which triggers a vulnerability in another mobile app that's, you know, embedded on the device by default. And that triggers RCE, right? I just think that's a really good chain and could be something good for any of you guys that are looking at trying to attack like vanilla mobile devices, thinking about AI and then using those AIs to launch intents.
Do you know if Google apps are like more trusted in the Android ecosystem? Like they're less likely to require like approval?
You mean like, you know, do you want to launch the YouTube app? That sort of thing?
Yeah, it's like if you're on Android, it might automatically happen.
I don't know. Maybe.
Well, where this takes my brain, which I think is going to be huge, it makes me want to go test it before this thing goes out. You know how I'm always thinking about delivery for AI vulnerabilities. And one thing is Q parameters, right? Where, you know, if you can, you can basically have a one click or a CSRF to a lot of delivery on these apps where the query is in like a specific GET parameter. And then I remembered that, in testing some of the desktop AI apps from Frontier Labs, there is a specific protocol like app name :// And when you do that, it automatically invokes the prompt.
Yep.
And so that makes me think that these custom handlers, especially on like mobile devices, like if you open up like a, you know, Q parameter based link via intent across Claude, across ChatGPT, across Gemini, will it auto execute those prompts? Because if so, then you have automatic delivery.
Mm. Yeah, dude. Yeah. It's good. It's good, man.
I want to go test it.
It's a good thing to be thinking of. Yeah. Okay. Dude, I got to bounce here in like 2 minutes. So let me hit this last one. And then if you want to do another one, you can. And if not, we'll cut it. Last one. This one's kind of crazy. I'm not going to lie, man. Like this one blew my mind a little bit. And I think it was you that mentioned to me that Brandon went to a talk on DOM clobbering. DEF CON.
Yes.
Yeah.
Dude. These young guys, they're like, oh, we're looking for internships. And it's like, you guys are super experts already. Tell me more.
Yeah, dude. It was like, these were, you know, university, they were associated with a university or whatever. Holy moly, dude. Like,
can we hire them? Have you reached out to them yet?
I don't know, man. I gotta talk to them or something, but they found a bunch of bugs, relating to DOM clobbering in things like Webpack's like bundler or runtime code, right? So every website uses Webpack ever,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
the runtime code that comes along with that was vulnerable to like a DOM clobbering. And it's just like, holy moly. Like, but anyway, essentially they took DOM clobbering super far because there are a lot of people that have kind of poked at DOM clobbering and tried to figure out how to do it. But essentially they formalized the whole thing and they like, you know, figured out, okay, we know exactly what things we can overwrite with DOM clobbering. Then we're going to like hook those and do a taint analysis and then build like the AST tree and correlate those to like the structure of the HTML that we would need to like mimic that flow to get, you know, our source to hit the sync. And they just like formalized the whole thing and like made it so essentially, you know, it would trace the code, you know, via taint analysis. And then it would say, okay, according to this tree, this is the DOM clobbering payload we need to reach the sync. And then it would generate that payload automatically and then detect whether it hit the sync. And they cleaned up with it, like almost 500 zero days. and bugs on Webpack, RSpack, Vite, I think is how it's pronounced. I've never had to say that out loud before. Google API client library, Astro.
Dude, how many of these do you think were being exploited by bug hunters in the wild? 500 zero days.
Yeah, dude. Well, it does require an HTML injection though, which is interesting, right? And so, you know, you've got to find that base piece, but once you've got it, then you've got these gadgets, right?
And that but goes, not anymore. Not if all these got fixed.
Well, yeah, a lot of them did get fixed, but a lot of them are not fixed still. So, you can check out the GitHub, link. It's DOM clobbering collection by Jack from East. We'll link it in the description, but the tool that they built is called the Hulk that does this automatically. Holy moly, dude, it was crazy.
All right, let me do my two super quick. It will take me literally one minute each.
Go for it, man.
Because these were not long. First of all, there was one by Mate Jose, Matei. It's called Smart Devices Dumb Resets, Testing Firmware Persistence in Commercial IoT Devices. Dude, this is one of those ones that I was like, we should have covered this on the spooky episode. Mm. Basically, really cool. Matt Brown got a shout out in it. But basically, he would buy devices like routers, flash the firmware with OpenWRT, return them, and then see if they did anything or if they just shipped them to a new customer, totally backdoored, and they would just ship them out.
No
he somehow
way.
Set up some like thing where he could pull for him to make sure he bought it. And his POC was something that would literally just make a GET request to his server, so it wasn't malicious. But he found out that there's basically zero validation on the market of returns. So if you're ever going to buy an IoT device or a router or something, the like it just scared me about that because now I just don't know whether the firmware's going to be backdoored.
Yeah, dude, that's crazy.
Crazy talk. So you should look that up if you're interested in that. The other thing was there was one called Mac PRT Cookie Theft and Intra ID Persistence. And it was one of those that was like way over my head. Basically a bunch of like low level, like Mac OS hacking and stuff. And anyways, but the thing I wanted to bring up was they talk a lot about SSO. And I think that if there are any of our listeners who are like just SSO experts or want to understand SSO better, I think you should definitely check that out because they had a bunch of really neat diagrams and a bunch of really neat explanations for how different forms of SSO work and how they're implemented from like a desktop perspective. And then a lot of it was clearly applicable to AppSec too. So that's it.
All right, man. Very good. I do want to say on that last note, that is also an IoT attack vector, by the way, is if you can persist a factory reset on the device, that is a valid bug, in my opinion, some of the IoT people that I've dealt with. So it's just not like a threat vector thing I think of very often. But
yeah.
All right, man. Is that a wrap?
Yep, that's a wrap. Thanks.
Right. Peace, y'all. And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for watching to the end, y'all. If you want more Critical Thinking content, or if you want to support the show, head over to ctbb.show/discord. You can hop in the community. There's lots of great high-level hacking discussion happening there, on top of masterclasses, hackalongs, exclusive content, and a full-time hunter's guild if you're a full-time hunter. It's a great time, trust me. All right, I'll see you there.